happy objects, sad objects. I'm not sure what my position is on sad objects, happy objects, other than I think us being kind of slightly resistant to thinking about how objects operate, and then I think I start to think slightly sentimentally about whether objects have sentimental values, and you know, thinking about whether you know what that means for objects to have then, for them to be something that can be possess some sentiment, and whether that's useful for objects to possess some sentiment. And I don't know in what kind of context, but I guess that's about as far as you know, think about it in a particularly kind of artistic or professional sense, just thinking about objects and their kind of whether they have this kind of resonance or not.
Or whether you give them.
Sorry?
Or whether you give them.
Whether you give them that.
I think it's, as we were speaking before, it's the energy that both create, primarily your energy bouncing off, particular energy of the object, the inherent energy of the object. But I don't know what that really means. Is there an inherent thing? For instance, does an object have more resonance with you than it does with me, and the difference in the resonance, and what energy that then creates in you versus the energy that it creates in me? Maybe sad for you, maybe happy for you.
It's because breaking down that notion of energy, what energy we're talking about, is it energy that makes you dance? Or is it energy that makes you
twist down?
Yeah,
so true.
And is it just energy then?
Yeah.
That's a particular kind of energy, isn't it? It's a particular sort of, it sounds like another time. Energy is a particular time. You think about an object kind of. Can objects accrue? I'm just wondering whether objects accrue a value, I suppose, and whether that value potentially has a sentimental. The idea of.
I wanted to find out whether there's a general characteristic, less than a kind of more relative characteristic, which would be this idea that, well, it's happy for you, but it's sad for me. It seems a bit useless, it doesn't get us anywhere.
Yeah.
Whereas if you think about an happy object as being generally happy, that's what it does, or generally sad, and then it seems like you can move somewhere.
Well, just trying to think through it, it's like, because of course, you know, that might mean something to me that's, you know.
But in a way, that's kind of particular.
Yes, exactly.
In a way, that's.
Yeah, exactly. So there's you know,
can
it's
you
incredibly
from
relative.
That?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
But the question is, does any object have inherent energy?
Well, this is it.
Well, I think that idea that an object can.
But I think that's what we need to talk about.
Getting whether past an that object kind of can actually have Again, it's kind of a global, more, and see, we were talking about essence earlier, this idea of kind of global essence, or kind of a more global or generic essence.
Or is there any essence in an object? Is it just meaning from the view of.
Can we say that every object is energy?
Yeah.
And then the next question, if we agree...
Not an energy we can necessarily ascribe to it.
If we just call it energy.
Energy, why not?
And then the next word is, what kind of energy is a happy energy that's energy?
How does that energy manifest?
That's what you want to
come up with. But it's all reflective.
I should find three, though.
Yes,
it's energy that you bounce off. and it's warmth in some way that comes back.
But that denies that general.
I know what that is.
That denies that general. That just brings us back to that relativist bind again.
Yeah. But even if there's. Yeah.
But I think it's really problematic. You can't move past that.
Even if there's universal religion, it's an awful thing. You feel it the same as I feel, which is what you're saying.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm trying to work out what Gary was asking.
Oh.
I'd argue that. There's no happiness or sadness in an object. They're just objects.
Yeah.
Don't give a monkeys whether we feel happy or sad about it.
Would
we're meant to feel happy or sad about it.
Would you agree that there's certain physical spaces that you should go in and anyone can feel the energy of that space? You, me, anybody here.
Like a kind of... some kind of affect.
A universal
energy.
Universal affect.
Like in Stonehenge or in the Arctic.
You know, I hope there would be, but
I'm not sure
there
is.
There are certain areas that seems to be a specialty of British researchers to ascribe definite energies to definite. There's a lot of them in the world. You can register the energy that guided encounters.
You can register this building.
Yeah.
And they've actually done it.
Yeah, I know. So, is there an inherent energy?
Yes.
Yeah.
But then it's breaking that down into saying, what energy it is.
Like
a physics energy, really, then. But then how we interpret that energy is different. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So the starting point is the energy. Everything's got energy in it. The next question is that we can't relate back to happiness or sadness. I might agree with you that there's no happiness or sadness in your hat for me, but maybe there is something that's different. And so it's your relationship you have, my non-relationship you have.
I'm saying, that can't take you anywhere.
Yeah.
You can't move beyond that.
And it doesn't go anywhere. Yeah.
It's complete hanky.
No, you can.
Because
then you talk about culture. The definition of culture is a shared meaning. I know that's a
well, exactly, and that's
you
why
know
you
that's
have
a
to,
you know
that's and that's why you have to diffuse subjective reading from that and look for a more general reading. A reading that is uber subjective.
Because actually, does that then relate to, a capital around objects, about how objects get sold to us as things that have certain qualities to them? You buy into that idea that something, an object, may possess something, may possess may you look better. Is there a sense that I'm just wondering, I don't really know what the question is either, but I'm just wondering what the value is of that.
Well, in a way, once
general kind of shared.
In a way, once you reduce it to money like that, then you might as well throw away this optimistic idea that objects can make people generally happy. What about if you just think about an apple tree?
Do you
know what I mean? Wow, an apple tree. That which is different.
Was possible. If
it is, it's not so good.
I bet she has to.
Well, yeah. She blighted many women with childbirth after that. Pain of childbirth. So I think, so are you looking for a kind of general, global, shared meaning?
I think that's the only way that you can move up. That's the only way that you can open up a space for a conversation.
The thing is, even though people have specific feelings towards objects, and that's an individual thing, most people probably have experienced this sentimentality towards objects. So even though it's different things for different people, most people do have this connection. Most people have experienced it, so you can look at that as a whole as a humanistic issue.
collective sentimentality, a collective.
Yeah. It's just a way of us responding to objects, that everybody knows. Maybe
you'll
get a general sense in that way.
But it's like, I use the apple tree as an example, the idea of kind of a blossom, yeah, something coming to light. Does that act as a general thing rather than an individual?
The fact that everyone can appreciate that.
That it might make people happy.
The thing is, though, then you can start to reduce that to an idea of kind of need, then. So it becomes like, makes you happy because you can eat that apple, you can eat an apple from the tree.
Or the other side of it is that when you have an apple tree you planted to commemorate someone who has died, then it makes me feel sad.
Or if I fell out of it and broke my arm,
definitely.
You would feel really happy.
You'd have cut that acid.
If you can even reduce it to, does a cube have a different reflective energy than a circle?
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because that's really how you test this kind of idea, is when you take it to a kind of abstracted extreme. The object is this kind of abstracted other. It's outside of it.
It's almost a concept.
How far do you have to abstract an apple tree to make it still relatable? An apple, if we said to about an abstracted apple tree, let's start from something as abstract. What would that be?
How far a distance would it have to travel? That abstracted from you that you could.
Away from
you. That assessment.
We had to burn it. Or would we just push it away from us? Is what on the horizon over there somewhere and not quite seeing it? And that whole sort of sense of the blossom, the touch, the closeness is gone. The sense that loss going on here further away. So those relationships, as we're closer and further away, are part of that sense of the object, the energy, the fading.
I think the energy dissipates over the time of the way, so it's harder to reflect back. If you're given the energy.
Yes, if you're given the energy.
Is yours being open soft? Very disparate, the further it goes up, it's harder to come back to.
But suppose the object has some energy. You get the burning apple tree. Because somehow we don't see the energy in the apple tree, which is always there, always present. But when it burns, it's a more obvious sense of the energy of the apple tree burning. And we sense, as a human being, we sense this apple tree burning. And therefore, the reflection is different from the apple tree. It just sits there with a blossom on it, or no blossom on it, or... So,
but is it the act of burning? I don't know. Are we talking about the energy within the object, or are we talking about our own energy that's reflected upon?
I think Gary's question is about whether there's an energy in objects.
Yeah.
Rather than one that we bring to it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
Whether there's a particular energy, I suppose. I was just thinking about that. You go back to the sphere and the cube. Yeah, that.
That's the great, in a way, what you just said is interesting, because that's the great, that's subtitle to this. Today, Bruno Latour talking about how we have this particular fetish, and it is to disallow autonomy to the object that we make. So you may. You can never know. That's the point. That there's a kind of humanist arrogance in idea that you can say that it has an energy, or that you can say that it's reflecting this thing back. And this is what Bruno Latour talks about in that subtitle for this thing today, it seems to me, is that what needs to happen is there's a fundamental questioning of that idea of human access and whether objects actually have an
independent energy
or an in itself that's
inherent.
Why
are we asking in the first place? Because we're never going to know.
try to separate. We perceive everything from a human vantage point. So we'll never know what it's like to be an object, to be that cat.
But we tell us when we would.
I don't know what it's like to be a cat.
If we had absolutely universal consensus on
that's still
what
irrelevant.
That object
still irrelevant. Because we can never detach our human experience from how we relate to that object.
Why would we want to? Why would we want to?
We are talking about having a belief. Why not just have a belief then?
You can have a belief, but it's not going to be. It's almost like what? Okay, so is belief is different, though,
that's
isn't
what
it?
You're talking about
the original question is like whether we can evidence the fact that somebody has got inherent energy. Regardless of whether there's almost somebody there with it in the room or not. Or is it humming away on its own, buzzing away like a fridge or something? And isn't that just dependent on our experience of it?
Well, we were talking about, we're talking specifically now about an object, but I was talking earlier when you weren't here about the energy of a space, for instance. Again, the inner circle of Stonehenge. I would suspect that, if not all of us, 99% of us would feel a similar physical energy if we went and stood in that space.
Okay. Is that less the object have an energy and more the construct?
But you're talking about
place has energy.
Yeah, he's talking about physical, physics, aren't this what we agreed on earlier. So I think about Mary Abramovich's pieces where she gets the audiences viewers to go along to the gallery and sit on the stones. These stones, I don't know the technical terminology, but these stones give out an energy. Yeah. You know, like fossil stones give out radiation.
Oh, like Ligeia Clark and
yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That's
we're
kind of like
so
objects in certain positions give off an healthy kind of.
So it's not about interpretation, it's about a physical,
it's about
physics, and it's scientifically measurable. Yeah.
Or not.
I always laugh.
No, I didn't mean to say not at all, I just say maybe there's another energy we got there, isn't it?
Yeah.
Maybe it's we that don't have it.
How do we know it's energy that we're measuring?
That's right.
It's because it's
we name it.
<What's
that?
laughs>
Well, you call it. You name it. You draw it.
It's unnameable.
You draw it.
But maybe it's to do with happiness.
Well, if it were, it should be. That's the point. If it were, it should be unnameable.
Jimmy Tarbuck, the famous artist comedian. He was just saying on the TV program today, you know, it was about disability and comedy, and he was just saying, if the audience laughs, it's funny. You know, so it's racist or sexist. It's going, you know, it's all about just making people laugh. I'm just thinking. I don't know.
Well, this is part of violence.
That's kind of what we're sort of saying. Well, it gives us energy. Everything gives us energy. There's no value judgment on it, or there's no criticality of it.
Well, in a way, this is violence that Colin and Martin seem to be talking about, because that's just a kind of nominalism. It's just reductive. You reduce it to its effect. That's all it ever is.
Yeah.
If it makes them laugh, then it must be funny. If it wags its tail and smells, it's a dog.
Yeah.
Oh, right, nice one. And everything that does that is a dog.
Yeah.
And everything that makes an audience laugh is a joke. It's kind of that part of the problem. This is what they're trying to deal with, it seems to me. Is this nominalist reduction of objects?
Well, I'm interested in that point that you picked up on, is this thing about looking. When you actually talk about something like a sphere, somehow the sphere acting is something between me and the object. So something between, it's not language, it's not spoken language, it's not the stuff we're...
It's an excess that you can't nominalise.
And it's not necessarily mathematics either, or a scientific objective device. So it's something about that in-between thing that
Are we on the sixth sense now? I don't know.
Because I suppose because problem with claiming that objects don't have an energy then is to reduce them to what we can know about. Because it might be unknowable. And why not? Unknowable in terms of language, in terms of knowledges, extractable knowledges.
Have we talked earlier on about sensing being different from knowing?
Because it is different. It's completely different. It's closer to thought than to knowledge.
And thought is not language.
Thought is not knowledge. There's a classical distinction between thought and knowledge that gets conflated, that people mix up. More and more people mix up.
Thought is
not knowledge. Oh, and so therefore not language.
Actually not language.
Yeah, no, good. That's good.
Definitely not language. If that really comes out of our mouth, it becomes language. So it becomes energy.
We think in languages.
No.
It's what's knowable. It's what to teach. What you can, in a really basic sense, it's what you can teach.
But if I think in English, what am I doing?
You're thinking in English.
Well, you're just doing language.
Yes.
You're just doing language, but we're talking about what exceeds that, that's closer to thought, and this might be a thing.
So it's nearer to dreams, it's back to the manifestation of dreams, as we manifest.
Well, it might be feeling in a space that all you can do then to articulate that is reduce it and fit it into this thing. That, and that's usually what we think thinking is that moment that we turn it into language in our minds, but that's not really the thinking. That happens previous to that. That's just concretizing to then externalize. And what if objects have that other thing? That can't be, because then it just be
all. It's in our subconscious then. It's unknowing. Is that right?
Maybe. I'm not 100% sure. I don't know where
it's going. No, because knowing doesn't exist once you're inside your own head. You've just got senses in mind. And it's how you make sense of your senses. So therefore, language speaks out of our mouth and goes through our ears. And sometimes a bit goes through our eyes, that looking thing. There's also touch. There's also taking something, smelling something. But somehow they get left out of the system slightly. So the sensing and our dreams is full of other things besides language. So our dreams are full of all that.
Language is part of it, surely.
Yes, because that's part of it, yeah. Well, I don't know, this is not the truth.
I think the problem is that it's the linguistic that then gets privileged.
Yes. It's the language.
That's the problem.
That's the crucial thing to say, the idea that's trying to unprivilege the linguistics, that it's trying to privilege touch and sense.
So within some relationship with language. It's this thing about the child and the playfulness of the child before language, the touching, feeling, tasting, and that thing about curiosity and imagination that's going on. That when you get more, I should say, get boxed into language and get their discourses all set up.
Well, I agree with that, but you were talking at one point, and almost this was the doorway, the skull almost. To a place where there was no language, which I
don't
agree with.
No, it was more about the process. I said it before, and then that gets forced into a linguistic framework, and that part of the process thought that then creates knowledge.
Yeah.
Sensing, so knowledge is constructed.
Yes, oh, absolutely, but there is language in the mind.
Some language is there, but there's a lot of other things there which we don't acknowledge.
So I always think of the mind in terms of being an apple, with the skin being the consciousness and the flesh being the subconsciousness. In terms of
I see it more like an onion. You can peel in the mind.
I like the onion.
little bits of the juice kind of come up to the surface right, now
right.
again.
That's right. And then I offer it to you.
Of energy.
Yeah, that's right. But it needs to burn.
Oh my goodness.
So how is this useful for objects?
Onions! For an onion!
Okay.
Yeah. It's reduced to an onion.
The cognitive consciousness only finds a very thin layer over this humongous ball of unconsciousness that runs everything. And we are viral robots.
I think I was reading the other day when children first pick up a crayon and they start to draw, that it's an action. They're not trying to draw anything. They're not doing any representational thing. They're not looking and trying to draw a shape. It's an action. And then over time, it becomes, they will draw that thing, or then they start to symbol to hearts.
But it's very, very interesting, that moment of the child recognising that it's not just an action, that it's actually...
It's that consciousness. But it's that pre-consciousness when they're not thinking about objects and themselves as being different, almost.
Yeah.
That's kind of intuition, isn't it? That's kind of like Bergson and intuition, which is this, you become free by finding that intuition, that kind of intuition. But I'm not sure whether
Well, the reason that's interesting is it goes back to thinking about this painting thing and about this us involved in the world and trying to touch things and move things about, and there's something very basic in that root. Remember what I said earlier on about painting, about the root of painting, where the root of painting is to draw. Or is it something that's before drawing or getting something to draw onto? It's just an action.
It's the child trying to find the extent of its physical, so he does something he can make a mark with. He's discovering his physical.
So he's measuring, measuring his body. So
but does that mean that there has to be a result?
How far can I? What is this? I can reach out, and then it morphs into. I can make a mark. Therefore, I can maybe duplicate.
So you don't think the record for that kind of understanding of that desire to know that thing needs to be recorded, it's just the action.
It's knowing about the action that's learning to.
Then how do you develop from that?
And because it's that, then it's pre-linguistic.
So that's thought. The action is thought.
The gesture is thought. Or correlative talk.
It's very interesting concept, because that's got the idea of the desire to know. It's really interesting because the child, I think, doesn't desire to know. But there is desire there, so that's... There's one about need, but that sense of the action, it feels that there is some desire there, but I don't think it's
the desire to know. It's the desire to know is physical.
It's just the presence of space around
it. Yeah, but it's the desire to know what that space is, what space do I occupy. But I can't see it if I don't have something in my hand to mark it.
But I don't think necessarily
I need to know. Yeah, I think it is a desire.
I can't see it, that element of seeing it and recognising it.
Sorry.
That idea of seeing it and recognising it.
They can feel it, but this is one more sense to give them one more idea of the physical that gives them a sense of the whole, I think.
Can I say, I work with children a little bit in education environments, quite young ones with parents, so it's like parents and children together. And they usually tell them to go away because they've gone to work. These parents were with them, which was fantastic. But the thing is, what happened with the child doing this thing before language, drawing stuff, is the parent went up to them before they could speak to them, oh, that's really good.
Yeah.
And it's that sense of, like, when we show something, like we've done a painting, we've done writing, we have to have that sense of, like, oh, you know. And in a way, you walk past and say, oh, that's okay.
Yeah.
And then you say, but. But with a child, there's that sense of real formation of, like, you're involved in the world now.
Mm.
So that sense of this design, comes about in a slightly displaced way, but it comes about through
imposed.
It's offered.
It's offered. Right.
By the parent who's the loved, who's the, is this the desiring object thing around the mother and around you. Therefore, the person you trust who offers you a sense of acknowledgement is much more accepted than the person you don't trust who offers you acknowledgement in exactly the same way. Which goes back to our teachers, actually. So the teacher you don't like, or just said, that's really good, you think, so what? The teacher is like you, like, think, says, that's really good, think,
that's about validation, that's about kind of...
So about the audience thing as well, about the offer from an audience, you think, I don't care what they say, but some audience, you think, I'm really glad that audience appreciated what I did. So in a way, that child enter into language, enter into knowledge, is quite a very interesting area. I don't understand it, but and the notion of desire within that very much as well. The desire to become involved, to be involved with other human beings, but with their parents in a way as well.
Why would you say the child doesn't desire to know?
It's that sense because they don't know what know is.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but they're learning to know about it now.
Yeah, but that's before they know they're knowing.
No.
Distinction in it, and if it's not, and if we are going to go down Bruno Latour route and say Donald Duck's an object as much as that is, as much as I am, as much as this whole space is. But then that just leads to a kind of a democratisation, a kind of homogenisation. But I have a real worry about
it.
Like in rhubarb sheds, quick force rhubarb, apparently if you're standing there you can hear it growing.
Really?
Because it's growing so quickly, because it's forced. Yeah. You can hear it.
I had this feeling, there were some orchids making really amazing sounds.
I have a textile design studio.
Yeah, we did really well.